So what was your home background? Was it urban or rural?
I come from rural background. Mm-hmm. But of course, as a, from my youngest days, I've been a student away from home, living in boarding, St. John's College, Paris, Royal College, Colombo, University of Colombo, University of London, and so on, you see. From just a little over the age of 6 to the age of 25, I was a student away from home.
At home, was it English speaking or Sinhala speaking or both?
Both. Both. My father was a medical practitioner, a product of the Ceylon Medical College in this time, who after a career in the department of 20 odd years, he was up and turned to planting. He became a very successful planter of primarily rubber and coconut.
With regard to the social origins, I asked that because I was interested in the language question, because the LSSP seems to have worked, at least the leadership, worked largely in English. No?
That is a totally incorrect impression.
Oh, I see.
Although we were all brought up fully as English educated people, we were the first people always to conduct our political activity in the Swabhasha. I can almost remember my own history. You see, when I came back from England, the only Sinhalese I had ever received as an education was the kind of thing that you had to do in all English schools in those days, where you had to pass the fourth standard in Sinhalese. You used to have 2 periods a week. There, I think we did more tomfoolery than learning our Sinhalese. So that, for instance, even today, I don't have any proper Sinhalese grammar. But when I came back in 1932, in that very year, I had to lead, personally lead a strike at the Vallabhadra Mill. And I still remember, you see, the first public meeting of theirs, which I attended, and they wanted me to take over the leadership of the strike, which had already begun. I insisted that they properly organize themselves, hold a meeting, and elect me to the post of president if I am to undertake the responsibility. So we held a meeting in Havelock Park, I still remember. You see, I could see it almost like this today. And after they had duly elected me, then I wanted to address them, being more than a little afraid that my Sinhalese would not be adequate to the task, I asked a group of people who were nearby whether any of them would translate me into Sinhalese. And I still remember the chapter, Tawdhir Chap came forward and said that he would do it. So I started with an audience which was mixed, in that there were Indian workers there, Indian Tamils, Ceylon Tamils, Indian Muslims, Ceylon Muslims, and Sinhalese followed. And I started out, I mixed, spoke my first sentence in Sinhalese, he translated it, I was unhappy. I spoke the second, he translated it, I was more unhappy.
You were speaking in English?
Yes, I spoke the third sentence, I was even more unhappy with his translation, so I said, thank you very much, I'll have a shot at it in my own way. I spoke in Sinhalese. And from that day on to this, I never spoken to the masters except in Sinhalese. It is correct to say this, that we had, because we are so strongly English educated, written up our major political documents for party views in English and engaged in translation, rather than writing them in the original Sinhali and translating them into English if necessary.
Did you have problems in your study groups with rising from the language and also perhaps from the question of expressing certain Marxist ideas in the Swabhasha?
Yes. You'll be surprised, we had to invent words. there are many words which are today being freely used and are current and are assumed to be parts of our living language, which were invented in the 30s by one or other member of our movement. Amazing number. When we started, words for very simple political concepts, leave aside Marxist concepts. Normal political. Even today, I say to you, though we as Marxists draw a distinction between the state and the government, there is no distinction in the single language. Says that we in our study classes use two different words. But in common parlance and even in educated circles, in Sinhalese, the two concepts are used interchangeably with the same word. We have been as a movement responsible to some degree for the development of our own Sebastian.
What about the level of the workers? Did you find it difficult to train them and to get them to understand the real Marxist ideology?
You see, Marxism is a highly developed philosophy started by us to be the acme of political of thought, the philosophical thought, arising out of the conditions of development in every field, including the field of industrial organization in the West. We started in a country which really had no concept of industrial form. You know, to them, when we came here, one factory they had heard of was the Velvet spinning and weaving mills. Most of them thought of a factory in terms of a garage or something. Right? Recent years that some idea of factory development and what a factory is has come to them. And even now they listen open-mouthed and wide-eyed when you decide, say, something like a Ford factory at Dearborn or something like that. Phenomenon outside there. They're not legitimate.
Is it correct to say that you concentrated on the trade union movement in the 30s?
No, it is not. We worked very hard in the trade union movement, and the modern trade union movement has much more roots in the work we did than in Gunasinghe's work in the 20s. But we did a tremendous amount of work in the countryside. And the pre-war Lanka Samasamaja Party and Samasamaja movement was quite as strongly based in the dissatisfied elements in the countryside as in the town.
As in the town.
We lost our rural base substantially during the Sinhala only.
In the 50s.
He took a firm stand on the question of Sinhala and Tamil. I'm not discussing whether it is correct or incorrect or partly correct and partly incorrect or anything like that. He took a very firm stand. He took a stand in terms of the equality of all races in the country. And we took a terrific beating. That is the period in which we suffered a grave recession in the rural area and which we have been recovering only in recent years.
You have been recovering it, have you? Now, in the 30s, in what ways did you work the rural area?
Well, with us, direct agitation and propaganda, as you can think of. You know, the normal everyday grievances of the village in relation particularly to the administration and sometimes to what I will call the people of power in the village. We were always identified with the types. Now, for instance, the headman was a felt principal oppressor in the village. And we set out with the demand from the very beginning for the abolition of the headman system. we even fought all such little problems as you would think of, the inadequacy of pasture land for the cattle in the village. Frankly, wherever there was a grievance, we were in the fight over the grievance.
I was wondering about the value of this anti-headman plank, in the sense that wasn't it a cry which exhausted itself once the system was reformed?
Yes and no, but I think the anti-headman issue is still alive. It's still alive, you see. However, those are merely, what I'm trying to say, various matters of felt grievances which could be the basis of agitation. If you ask me, you see, now we were identified very strongly with the demand for land for the landless. We worked very hard at it. We did a lot of agitation. But it is a singular phenomenon, which certainly I, as a responsible person in this movement, take very strong note of. There has been, in the last 20 years, 2015, a very widespread, very powerful, very insistent squatters movement.
That telephone conversation you did.
Now, which you would have expected that the revolutionary parties would have somehow, you know, found a way to organize that movement against the movement of revolutionary potentialities. I think it must be faced up to that the revolutionary movement simply failed in relation to the fact. We never, no party of the left has been really leadership. It became thus a spontaneous movement to the landless. It just began to march in.
But then isn't your land for the landless something akin to helping this?
Yes, yes. Wherever we came into contact with it, we have been always studying for the permit to be obtained, studying to prevent the fellow who's brought to court being punished and so on. But you know, giving the movement the shape of an organized movement has not been done.
With regard to this appeal to the peasantry, weren't you hindered by the fact that you were competing with D.S. Senanayake, in the sense that he himself was pushing an agrarian program, and therefore was in a sense spiking your guns, and in the sense that he himself was a popular figure?
Well, I would say the fact that the distribution of land was part of the deliberate land development policy of the government undoubtedly, shall we say, channelized the satisfaction of the landless in directions which were not necessarily public. It's more a question of how to get that an allotment. And thereafter, the struggle for getting governmental assistance in the development of the allotment. We were in all that. But of course, that turned it in a different direction, as you said.
How popular was DS in the 30s? Because historically, I think we must be careful not to read the DS the man of, say, 1950 into the 30s. How well known was he among the people?
Even then, I think he was recognized as the most powerful figure in that school of politicians, although the man of greater prominence was about that. Certainly already by the time I came into politics, however important Sir Baron Jayatilaka was, nobody would overlook this. I can show that case. When the Lanka Sansamaja Party was launched in 1935, and I, as its first and historically its only president ever, we never had any other president. I was there till we stopped having a president during the beginning of the war. My very first speech made a terrific onslaught on DS Senanayake. I remember pointing to three, reactionary trends in the country, main trends, and showing how they met at a certain point. And I still remember the phrase I used. I said, and at that meeting point stands the baleful figure of Don Stephen Fenimax. I think that got stuck in my mind because it appeared as a huge headline in one of the Sunday papers. But what I mean is, is that important, isn't that?
To the man in the street, to the peasant?
I think, he bore the Senanaka name. And although at first Senanaka was the more revered figure, and although I think B.A. Senanaka rose to political power on Effar's shoulders, so to speak, nevertheless, yes, showed himself a powerful, a positive, and frankly, a complete representative of the landowning section of this country. No question.
How did D.S. manage to marry this land, this, the demands of the peasants, as with his obvious alliance with some of the feudal oppressor class? Or was an obvious alliance?
It was the alliance. It was there. But, one has also to think in terms of the extent of the development of the peasant's own thinking. I myself, you will note, I don't use the term peasant when I'm talking to you. I've spoken always in rural areas and so on. You see, we don't have very much of the classical peasantry that appears in Marxist literature in terms of the feudal setup in the West. But today, largely the leftover, the hangover in the form of the Andhra system and the Andhra Gopi.
Sacrifice.
Not very much more. You have the areas of Sabadam and so on. The social power of the feudal families is greater than their property position. Moreover, I think it's very little realized, you see. In British times, so many laws were created in respect of land tenure and changes to the tenure system. But there has been a slow process of erosion also, side by side, the development cycle.
Slow process of erosion of what?
Of the feudal property relationship. You see, since 1870, we have the legal means for a feudal tenant to become, on a nominal payment, a landed proprietor. These things have been utilized. I wish you would set a group of your students on a task which have always been urging upon everyone in the history department in the university that I know.
Country records.
And the district court records to the main centers in the island. You will see them, literally the mechanical process of the breakdown of feudalism. If somebody works in the Ratnapura Kachari or in the Kani Kachari, incidentally anyone who is interested in producing the genealogical tables of the families, the partition cases will give them all. But what I mean is a different thing, how the feudal tenantry, through the processes of the law, assisted by the introduction of the private property concepts which infused the approach of the judges to the whole feudal relationship, steadily broke down the whole Nilagama system. We should have a 500 studies of it. And I am sure there will emerge a totally new concept of this whole Vadavasam system that we have had in Singh. I'm very sorry about that.
In fact, did the LSSP party in the Sama Samajis in the 30s take into consideration this basic problem, namely that the peasants were not, say, not all that oppressed and basically had a root in the country, had property and were smallholders or smallholders in outlook?
You're wrong there. You know what the land surveys of the 30s showed?
Yes.
That the popularly accepted, generally accepted belief that we had very little landless peasantry, and generally a peasantry with land, you know, that belief was completely exploded by those surveys. They deliberately started with a survey in the Kalutara district.
Yes.
Because that is one of those areas where small landed property was believed to be extensively diffused. They found, I'm speaking from memory, but I think about 30 to 40% landless, and probably over 70% with less than an acre.
No, be that as it may, did the Sama Samajis of the time before the survey have this general concept?
I think it's more accurate to answer that this way. We were more concerned with the grievances arising from oppression than with what really were the much subtler relations that arise from the question of land ownership and that relationship.
Subtler question?
Yes, because you know that there is from place to place, from area to area, village to village almost, this whole business of what is the pattern of land ownership in the island. You see, we came into the political movement in the immediate aftermath of the Great Depression of the 30s. That, of course, created an almost special position because large masses of people had lost their land during that period. How much of it was recovered during the war, I don't know, I wasn't there.
Now, in your legal experiences in the 30s, you noticed this foreclosing and losing of land.
You see, I had a double advantage. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, in my historical studies, I'd studied the land tenure system pretty thoroughly. I was amazed. I seemed almost to be an expert on the Mandarin on style crowd. On the other hand, I came up against it all in the law. And especially in the pre-war times, I did really more civil work than criminal work, though my reputation is on the criminal side. And I knew much about the situation. Now, I knew, for instance, the socially adverse consequences of the partition, of the law of partition, in the southern and western provinces. Which most people didn't realize, you know. That was an effort to create the English system of individual land ownership on a large scale. It has been a conspicuous failure, although it has resulted in a lot of land going into the hands of the lawyers.
Yes, hasn't it also helped some of the, say, local big bucks to seize land?
Yes. You see, you get hold of a small share, and then you launch an expensive litigation. Now we have introduced reforms limiting costs and so on. In those days, by the time you finished the partition action, the bill of costs could be double or three times the value of the land, so that the lawyers could go against your other properties. Not the matter. You now kept it down to one-fifth of the value of the land, you see.
No, I was wondering about this question. Looking at the nature of the present rain synod in the 30s, did the Samasabhajis have doubts about their value as a basis of support to a revolutionary party?
No. We did not have that kind of theory. Of course, we were very anxious to, first of all, one might almost say, have the working class organized, politically conscious, class conscious. Because, in our view, the working class of Ceylon was, even at that time, a larger proportion of the mass than usual in an underdeveloped country, from concentrated in certain places. But then, of course, all the time we were coming up against the special problem of the estate worker. You know, if the estate worker was, in fact, indigenous, and had originated from the village, though parted from his land, the history and development of our movement would have been a whole really different thing.
You would have been stronger.
Not merely stronger, but probably decisively stronger. I don't think history would have taken the shape of the last 15, 20 years.
So you didn't have doubts about going to the presidency, whether it was worth it?
No. I said we just got pushed out of the rural areas, but the hostility became so great that they couldn't even hold a public meeting.
55, 56. In fact, the whole language question, weren't you caught napping?
Yes. Not caught napping. But because we had been struggling for the Subhasha from the beginning of our movement. I can show you in innumerable documents if I could lay my hands on them, not to mention other efforts. But the real question was elsewhere. When it took the single only turn, we came into a head-on clash with the thing. I think that, you see, now there are those who now write very learned articles about the cultural revolution and so on. I don't know, we stood firmly for the right of, excuse me a moment, the Sinhala only, and the building up of the Sinhala Buddhist movement in clash with and opposition to the Tamil. That, in its virulence, I think you are entitled to say caught us napping. I don't know whether if we had appreciated it, we would have changed our principle, though we might have modified our tactics. You follow? Indeed, looking back, much to be mulled over on the question of what is the correct tactical line to put forward our ideas. I'm very doubt in my mind that even if we had known the full sweep, that it would have taken a different line. I think we would have taken this line then, insofar as I judge and understand the party. But I think we have been very much more cautious in the application of the line and in the way we work towards our objectives.
With regard to tactics, once the plantation workers were disfranchised, don't you think that your attachment to this plantation group was a mistake, in the sense that it might, I'm not sure here, but I'm just putting forward as a theory, might have lost your support among the Sinhalese peasantry, and in that, without gaining anything in particular?
Yes, but then, unless you turn to an anti-Indian land, what other land is possible? You see, today, it is one thing in terms of the organization of a front aimed at a coalition government to enter into terms amongst the parties for a line of activity. It is another thing to cease to look at the problem in the way that you that are moved on. I hope that our movement has not ceased to look at it the way we have traditionally looked at it. I myself am a participant in the particular policy measure that I embodied in the agreement between our parties. I stand by them firmly, I defend them aggressively. But that is not an adoption of the point of view of other parties. It is only a meeting of points of view resulting in particular points of measure.
So, am I correct in saying that the present arrangement you regard as a compromise meeting point?
Yes. It is those things where, in the larger interest of the forward movement of the entire progressive process in the country, you give the answer.
Well, presumably you have to, politically speaking. In otherwise you would never go ahead.
Yes, otherwise you have got to, the ultimate thing is you've got to tell the other party that you accept our program, you go to hell. If you say that, you are really saying, please join our party. Which is not politics. I do not, of course, think that we have given up anything fundamental, because that would be a different question. This problem has now, this Indian problem, has narrowed itself in compass to a very clear problem, whose outlines can also be clear. That is, what are you going to do about the 975,000, now 1 million or more, people of Indian origin who have neither the citizenship of Ceylon nor the citizenship of India, and are here? That is why, for instance, the present law does not serve to solve. It is not in terms of the fact. In fact, India took a very important, made a very important departure from all its past positions when Shastri agreed with Mrs. Bandaranaike that he would hitch the question of Ceylon citizenship to the question of repatriation to India of the other sex.
As to that proposal?
Yes. 525,000 to be repatriated. To whom? There was the further addition in the agreement that the government of India stated it will give citizenship. That had nothing to do with the repatriation. They would repatriate and give them citizenship or any way they like. But the point was 300,000 to be made citizens by us. They are here. There is no question of any repatriation or settlement. In relation to 525,000 to be repatriated to India. So that they are going back to India was the condition precedent for the citizenship question to take place here. Personally, I think Mr. W. Jagannath has gravely imperiled the solution of the question.
How?
It is in only in terms of the agreement that we can demand any repatriation of this 525,000 or any proportion of it in the future. The fact that they get Indian citizenship does not give us the right we have had of saying, well, you're not my national, under the following conditions, please go. Even there, the other country is not bound to take, but then there's a difficulty, there's a problem, they're ordinarily able to take them. But now, any one of these people, even while India makes the man his her citizen, she can say, I won't take her back unless you do it in terms of the back. all the other conditions. So we are saddled with it all years, inasmuch as we can end up with India giving all 525,000 citizenship, but with only a small proportion of them gone from this country. And then that is worse, you see. No, if you have these men stateless here, as they are termed, it is always open to the Ceylon government to find ways and means of assimilating them into our society. But if you have them as Indian citizens here, you are having a permanently alien element legally ensconced in the heart of your country. From the point of view of even simple security, it is ridiculous. He is, of course, paying in terms of his own private political agreements.
If I could switch to some sort of odds and ends, in fact, with regard to the peasantry and this specific grievances you were raising in the 30s, I was wondering whether you limited this to the election years, 36 and then 47, or whether you kept pushing it.
So our work was continuous.
But did you have a card in the...
In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if a pretty goodly proportion of our LSSP membership came from the rural area.
But more or less, mostly sort of provincial town lawyers, I suppose.
And look, that, they are very small, they are a negligible crowd. You'd be surprised at the normal village person we have. Some of them even now send messages to us when they are on their deathbeds, please come and see us somehow, even though we have parted over the years. Oh, no, no. This idea that we hadn't that type of element very much. What was the provincial lawyer we had after all? Hardly identifiable in my memory. Don't know that.
There has been some mention to of an all-Ceylon Peasants Congress in 1945, and A. Gunasekara's name is linked with this. What was this movement?
It was never a movement. It was more an advertisement, which is not unusual in the world. Gunasekara, who came from the LSSP, ended in the CP. And he was sought to be built up as a kind of local NG Ranga. You know, a kind of local peasant leader. He ran about a lot, but I don't think he ever built an organization worth the name, although he engaged in a lot of activity.
Now, he formed a radical party. I presume that...
As he ended up that way, you know, he became a royist. That's what these radical democrats were, royists. Actually, this was all a steady passing out of the mainstream of the movement. You see, we have shown a great capacity to splinter. We are rather French in our ways.
Where was his base? In what areas did he try to get peasant support?
Frankly, he operated from Anuradhapura at one time. I think primarily because he thought he could cover the consequences. I know the fellow well, I knew the fellow well.
And it was after that that he gravitated to the CP? Or before?
He had already gravitated to the CP by the time he went into the NCP.
Did he stay within that for long, within the CP?
For quite a number of years. Then he broke away. Drifted away is perhaps more accurate than broken. There are large numbers of people like that. You know, you'll be surprised how many people even in these other parties, including the newer types in the UNP, have had some connection with our movement at some of their younger stages. Any kind of radicalism expressed itself by some kind of association with our movement.
When those estate strikes started in the 40s, did you have any ideas of sponsoring them with a view to hindering the war effort?
We were not thinking in terms of the war effort. You know, we didn't sort of try to create strikes to hinder the war effort. That also would be theoretically wrong. The correct description of the line is that you continue the star struggle regardless of its consequences to the war. Not in order to cause a defeat or something like that. That's my view. Of course, this is the celebrated theory of revolutionary defeatism, which even in the Leninist forms of expression, view at times correct. Lenin had a way of sometimes overstating a thing in order to drive home the matter. This, I think, what I said is the true content of it.
Uh-huh. And how useful were the youth leagues in the 30s? Did you...
You see, we haven't a major youth league movement. But the original forms of organization out of which the party arose included some which called themselves youth leagues. There were no more youth leagues then than our youth leagues are youth leagues now. Really, the youth leagues of today that we have are ancillary party organizations of people who identify themselves with the party regardless of their age, but who are not ready to undertake the level of activity that we demand of a party member. In all other respects, they are damn good LSS players.
So say we take a town now, Matugama, do you have a youth
league?
There
was no youth league there.
No. Say any area, A, do you have a party branch and at the same time a youth league?
Or? We have the party local, which is on a much higher level of development and activity. We try to cover the entire country as far as possible with youth leagues, which are broader, less systematic, less continuous almost as organizations. They have a habit of coming into being, disappearing, and as soon as the atmosphere gets acute, up they emerge and all the fellows who have disappeared reappear.
As such times of the election, then.
Nowadays, but they all emerged in the Hartal in 1953. I could almost draw you a map, you see, I can swear to it. That if you want to know where the Hartal became strong and really stood up, bound to have been a youth league.
And a sort of an old youth league coming up again.
Yes, it may have re-emerged, it may have been new, but some kind of youth league organization would have been in that area.
In fact, how widespread was your support in the Hartal?
Well, I wrote a pamphlet at that time which was directed to, considering that matter, I don't know where it is. Ask anyone whether he has a copy, you know, Amarnath Commander has been there.
I'll ask him.
Hartal. There's an estimate there, and the pointer to the actual area where it occurred, in terms of actual manifestation of activity.
Isn't it true that, speaking very generally, the basis of your support, countrywide support, has been in the south, west, and the sort of the connection between Colombo and Kandy, that Kegal area?
Sabrugano?
Yes.
The Kandy Valley.
How would you explain your weaker position in the central province and over?
Well, not that the day, guys, strictly speaking. You know, the western province, for instance, is the most advanced area from any point of view we have in Ceylon. And if we don't get a response in those areas, it's ideal to think of a response elsewhere. Mm-hmm. The Kandyan provinces, the Kandyan village is very difficult to reach, you know. And we probably concentrate more on the plantation than on the village, though we've been to the village. But we concentrate more on the plantation than on the village. then I would have something to do with it. And the village, the problems with the Canadian village are overshadowed by this whole question of the plantations in their midst. And with our position on the Indian question, we do not have the means to appeal with the Canadian village.
Is there a question of transport too?
Yeah, exactly. You've got to either to go to the mountain top or to the valley bottom. It's a curse, you know. It's a curse. And the plantations are difficult because you can't get into them. Well, the up country is a very special, you know.
Yes, you must have had quite some problem in 40 and 41 working on the plantations, traveling into them. Did you use Anthony Pillay at all?
Anthony Pillay, I think, was already in India. I'm not sure. No, he wasn't. He was in 42. But he didn't primarily concentrate on that.
Oh.